You are listening to Let's Go JoJo, the weekly JoJo's Bizarre Adventure podcast from Dynamite in the Brain and Secret of the Sailor Badness, so come along and hang with the Let's Go gang. It's Dwayne.
Hey, how are ya?
It's Niall.
Guten Abend.
And it's me, Brian. And this week's episode is Moody Blues Counterattack, or is it Crunchyroll? Moody Jazz's Counterattack.
It's like, let's put a different kind of music in there. That's fine as well, right?
I mean, one was the dog, the other, that's okay, I guess. Yeah, sure, why not? It'll do.
It'll do. Maybe the motto of this part five of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure.
Like, I'm generally excited to see what ending fucking theme they stick on, and like, I'm still not on board with the new one, but I do laugh every time it comes on.
I like it.
It doesn't jazz me up.
You know? Well, it's supposed to kind of wind you down.
Yeah. I guess it's like the ending of the last ending on Stardust Crusaders. That was kind of like that. Oh, this is nice. Or I wouldn't necessarily call this ending theme nice, but I'm looking forward to the ending theme and what fucking copyright infringement dodging they're going to fucking do. And it's always, like, terrible.
So, before the credits, we open with a flashback as we get the secret origin of Peter Parker, Spider-Man. Sorry, Leone Abaccio.
There's going to be a superhero who went like a cop and then got superpowers after, right?
Well, yeah, but his origin is not stopping the criminal, letting the criminal go, and then
kill his uncle,
he
though.
Cares. Nah,
yeah, he but... his partner. His partner on the force.
Oh, that's true, okay.
So we learned that Leone was a corrupt cop.
Well, at first he was a good cop, and then, since everything was shit, he became a corrupt cop, because it's like, fuck it.
Point is like,
I might as well get paid rather than the courts getting paid and the lawyers getting paid to get these guys back on the streets. I'll just keep them on the streets.
This shit system. Why should I just be another fucking mindless cog in it?
I should make some money off this.
Benefit off of it.
Yeah.
If everyone's corrupt, then I may as well be too.
Yeah.
And then he's his partner getting killed by a guy he turned a blind eye to earlier in his flashback. And then that makes him hit even lower until he is pulled out of the gutters by Bruno.
It's nice to see the Italian police force don't mind you just dressing like a goth, even in full uniform. That's pretty good.
He's in mourning. His partner was just killed.
Is that why he's wearing that little hat thing? Is that part of his mourning process? And to go full goth as well, obviously, when he was kicked off the force.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think it's more like, while you couldn't create a public good inside the system, by the quote-unquote legal way, so maybe the only true freedom is to lean into being a crook, and then when there are no laws, you're free to create your own justice.
You're free to be a good crook rather than an evil crook. And, yeah, that's the deal. Obviously, he's getting recruited by the guy who wants to be a good crook.
Yes. And then we see what happened at the end of last week's episode, as Giorno rushes to prove himself and to basically
use his body as a demonstration of what the stand power they're dealing with is.
To get Abaccio to use his stand to figure out what's going on.
His stand is confusing. I mean, like, lots of things are confusing about this episode, but even that's confusing.
I will say it watches better than it reads, because I was baffled for a good portion of when I was reading this. And I suppose it helps having reading it. I have to have the gist of what was happening, but to see it actually animated moving around, I was able to better figure out, that's how it works.
And you can see the running clock on the guy's head and everything, so that probably helps a little as well.
Especially with Moody Blues, because it's probably... Moody Blues, the conceit of it is it can replay events. It'll from like certain points. So
it'll reenact like one person's actions for a certain amount of time, and it's a lock in the time.
Yeah. This example, Moody Blues, it kind of transforms into a copy of Narantia from like 5 minutes ago, and they can kind of follow his movements and see what happened to him, and then get a better idea of what's going on. And that works a lot better in animation and motion, because you can just like, they're just like fast forward.
You can reuse the animation, just take out his radio and the other person in the scene, that kind of thing.
Well, I mean,
I thought there was I'm not saying, obviously it was cheap as well, but I really liked the idea of like them replaying the animation, but not all the scenery is there. That was kind of fun.
Yeah, but I mean more so you could get a better understanding of how it works, because they're just kind of fast forwarding and rewinding stuff.
Yeah.
As would a videotape.
Well, yeah, it works. It's a video based power, so it works better in video. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So to do that, Dave, like make a copy of Narancia and see what happened to him before he got vanished. And they surmised, he got pulled down the drain somehow. So, I see. He's not stabbing them. The enemy side is stabbing you directly. It kind of punctures you like and lets the air out of you like a balloon. And then now he's all floppy and kind of weird and disgusting. Then it's easy to pull him down the plug hole then. And that's where he is. And that's probably what happened to the rest of the dudes as well.
So they're not dead. They're just, like, I think he says specifically deflated condoms. And I think that's to get into the reveal later on. And I was like, what a fucking gross comparison. So that they're... he takes all their insides out, but that doesn't kill them. So they're just like a bag of skin that can fit inside a pipe. Yeah.
No, I was the same. I was like, why on earth would you make that analogy?
The only reason is the reveal.
Hardened gangster. You wouldn't do it. I guess. The balloon. He's using condoms.
But yeah, I think you're right, Dwayne, that it's to make sense of what happens at the end. If that could ever be made sense of.
Like, I think I get it. I think I do. But it is so weird, I don't think I do.
So the lads obviously think, oh, well, he's obviously puncturing the guys and he's hiding them, like, within, like, the confines of the ship, like, inside the pipe or something like that.
In the heat, and, yeah, there's lots of places he could fit a deflated human, or several deflated humans, yeah.
Yeah, so I was saying, fucking Moody Blues in there and see what's going on, and you can do these, like, sticky fingers, Bruno, to just unsurpass the ship and go inside and see where they are. But they do this, and they can't seem to find anybody. But they should be here, because, like, The Rancius shoe that Jono turned into a fly and kind of hovers around where he should be is still over the area where they're looking, but they don't see Rancius as a deflated body or any of the rest of them there at all. So what the hell is going on here?
And obviously that's a proof that Jono is still alive and Rancius is still alive, because both of his power is working and his shoe is still trying to find his master. When later on, I thought he was inside the fly, because it kept, like, showing your man in contrast to the fly while they were having that conversation. And I was like, is he hiding inside the fly? Because it was just such a weird visual of, like, you know, like, the talking head of the fly in contrast to his against the
man. Because that's when, like, a Bacchio, like, he gets got and he gets punctured and pulled in as well. And it did seem like, the fly is, like... Like
taunting him,
Bruno. Like, haha, you'll never catch me now, Bruno. I've got
like
all
it's
your
spinning
boys.
Around him really dramatically at one point, and I was just like, this is a weird scene that plays for drama. Because, I mean, like, if you just think of it, that's just the dude standing still while a fly goes like flying around you.
And then, thankfully, I'm looking at the Wikipedia, because I do not understand this within the show itself, of exactly how the blood was the clue that there was a second boat.
I think it probably should have lingered on the shot a little longer, because it looks like the blood trail is leading down... Oh, crap. Below deck? Is that what it's called on a boat?
Yeah, below deck.
But it stops right before the actual hatch. And so he specifically cut himself to show that the blood wasn't going below deck. It's going into the deck, I guess, is the way you could put it.
The JoJo's Wikipedia says Abaccio has purposely made his hands bleed by punching the walls.
Yeah.
But his blood is nowhere in sight inside the boat. Thus, there is a second boat hidden somewhere.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Also, Bruno Freeletis, didn't we rent, like, boat number one? Why is the all the stuff, the lifeboats and the masts and everything else, say boat number two? And that's when he figures out this fucker, he punctured an entire boat, deflated it, and somehow, like, stretched its form on top of the boat that we rented.
Yeah.
And he's not been hiding the guys inside the pipes or anything. He's been hiding them in the gap between the actual boat and the deflated one, the layer in between it. That's where he's putting them.
he's made a boat into a condom that you can fit a boat into.
So the zipping was not actually to discover where Zucchero was, it was actually to sink the boat, forcing him to
surface.
Well, he has to come up because he'll still drown inside the skin of in between the skin of a skinned boat and a boat. Yes. Fucking weird sentences Jojo makes me say.
Yes.
And he takes care of Zucchero by doing a rocket punch.
Yeah.
Yeah, because obviously your man has a knife on the ex-cop, and it's like, I'm going to stab him, and he's like, I'll kill you before you get the chance, kind of thing. It's like, well, he's standing all the way over there, but he can unzip his arm, as he figured out from Giorno. Get that rocket punch gone.
And then I think we get the capper of the flashback, of which felt a bit flat as the end of this episode. But also, again, I suspect anything would feel flat after the reveal of there was a boat hidden inside another boat.
Yeah, I feel like it should have nearly been like a flashback where it shows like that he walks up to him and he's like, I absolutely trust you and I want you in my gang. And it kind of, and then to do the fucking reveal, you know, that kind of way?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think
like if you got the emotional beat and then the batshit fucking crazy beat after that, that might have been better.
Anyway, everyone's reflated, and we can move on with the hunt for Pol Pot's treasure, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, if it may help as well. It may help as well if you knew what Zucchero's stand name was. To help figure out the power of Soft Machine. I thought, okay, he's probably doing something, some kind of play on words with that. He can make them softer and squidging them down into small places.
Right. You know, yeah. Because it's never actually said out loud, is it?
No, we get the...
You get the power level thing, yeah.
Is it amazing?
Yeah, it's in the eye catch where we get the English name is Tender Machine.
That was it, yeah. It's a synonym.
Like, did the fun translator just crack open a thesaurus and just like broken down from all these fans?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, some of these names are so lame, I wonder whether they're coming down from... Japan rather than the actual translator.
Oh, that would explain them just being fed into a thesaurus. Yeah.
Like they're some of them seem a little too literal and not very inventive.
Yeah,
like Zendata and Mondata was a different. No, it wasn't a different Sting thing. It was a different.
Because they were Oingo and Boingo, and they changed it to
Zendata Mondata. Yeah, like which shows that you at least have a knowledge of it. But you know, it's like blues and jazz. It's like close enough. Yeah,
yes. Zipper Man.
I mean, come on, can get away with it because he's using zips, but he's very clearly not saying that. But you know, they can't disguise that, no matter how much they try.
I mean, that's the advantage, is you can hear the dialogue, so you can ignore the subtitles.
Yeah.
Similar in Double Decker later on.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Where they're clearly saying one English phrase, but another one is appearing in the translation.
Yes.
Yeah. They're trying to trick me into thinking it's not their version of England by keep saying prom. I think so.
We'll get on to that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I was like, this and the next part of my stumbling blocks when I was reading the comic these powers are a kind of hard to wrap my head around seeing them play out in motion animation. I think it is a little less confusing, especially as I said before, Moody Blues, but also how Soft Machine works and getting everything, disguising the boat and all the rest of the stuff you did. But still, maybe you know, afterwards you look at the comic, or as Brian did, look at like a wiki page, and just maybe put the pieces together for yourself, because it is definitely trying some ambitious stuff to try and put on a comics page.
Yeah, and I mean, like, even with the animation, it's difficult to represent that a boat is inside a boat.
Yeah, rather cool stuff here, but I'm wondering if my confusion with reading it was shared with a lot of readers, because it seems to fall into a certain rut. What enemy stands in the remainder of the comic, which I kind of pattern on some of these things, so I thought maybe just do some more of that. Don't be anything kind of crazy like this.
I mean, like, that could have been an editor thing where it's just like, okay, that didn't make any goddamn fucking sense. You've explained it to me, you've used diagrams, but I still don't get it. Like, can we just have a guy who punches and goes aura or something?
Yeah.
To be fair, if you're reading the current Hunter x Hunter chapters, then this is basic mathematics. And if that ever gets animated, I've no idea. Have you seen that page this week, of which is almost an entire page of text?
Explaining what just happened, or
what's about to happen, or what might happen,
okay. What could happen. Yeah, it's literally just
just people theorizing how it might go down. Okay,
so like, you know how, like, maybe like, to give a more crass example, say in Death Note, where they had the whole page point, and he knows that I know that I know that he knows that he knows that I know that I'm Kira, but he doesn't know that I know that I know that he knows that he is L, and all kind of back and forth.
Yeah.
I had your plan figured out, but. He's my plan figured out, but he thinks I definitely figured out, and so on and so forth, in a fucking continuous loop until you fucking get bored and close the comic.
Until you stop at, like, figuring it out, number 17, yeah. And it's like, but yeah. That's my Lynch, that's how I get in.
And Death Day's only got two people involved, guessing backwards and forwards. Yeah. This has 14 people involved in a contest, plus the Hunters who've got their own agenda, plus the Phantom Troop who've got their own agenda, plus Hisoka who's got his own agenda.
So, like, do you need a fucking diagram to explain this shit, or how does it work?
Yeah, plus there's a bunch of characters who are technically on this boat and haven't been seen for years at this point.
He does like diagrams, but it doesn't really make it any clearer. I think you should probably, like elect a spokesperson for each faction and then just go to... He's cut down a lot of his, like, inner monologues, because why do I need to hear everybody's inner fucking monologue? Yes. Just, like, make one guy the leader, he's in charge, and let's let them form the plan, and then it's much simpler to follow.
Because it's not even just those 14, it's all their subordinates, you're getting all their thoughts as well. And in some cases, like, there's, like, somebody who's got a power which now allows him to force his subordinate's mind into the body of somebody else, and so, like, it's...
I feel like some of these fighting manga need people working under the creator who can make a PowerPoint presentation or like a descriptive pamphlet or, you know, like a simple like breakdown, like Lego instructions just with pictures where it's like, oh, I see. Okay. Now I follow it. That kind of thing. Just to figure out what the fuck is going on sometimes.
Yeah, I think the comics diagram is definitely a skill which not everybody has.
Oh, yeah, no, it's a very specific set of skills. And no offense to the artists and their mad bastard brilliant ideas, but they do need to bring someone in if they can't get it across.
Well, she does need to probably just write the thing, let someone draw it, as I've been saying for a long time now. Because it's the drawing more so that's causing him the crippling pain and thinking about it. If he's just writing it, like... and having somebody else do it.
Someone else's problem. You fucking draw this shit.
But he insists on doing it all himself because no one can touch
his
vision.
That's the way of it. Yeah.
I thought, fuck on, Akira Toriyama's grandmother is writing stuff and doing the odd characters in Dragon Quest and just letting Toyo Taro do the Dragon Quest Super Fun manga. So maybe
he just does stuff that he feels like is fun, which is, like, that sounds like great. That sounds like a great fucking job, man.
I suspect what's fun for him, though, is those months where he's not drawing and then he gets to think of all this shit that he's going to put in the next 9 chapters he does.
While he convalesces, in a bed, smoking on a morphine drip or something because he's in serious pain.
Yeah, maybe that's how he gets the good shit.
That's where he gets all his ideas from. He's like, because he's a powerful painkillers, and...
Well, that and the time he has to do it.
He's a journal next to his bed. Whoa, that's a cool idea for a power. Write that down. Oh, I'm going to get sick.
Oh, dear.
That's this week's JoJo's Bizarre Adventure taken care of, but what else did we watch this week? It's time for the podcast within the podcast. Let's go with Space Battleship Tiramisu's Why, Episode 6, In No Way Beyond the Origin. The first half involves a real baseball player showing up in the hospital room that as Suzu visits Subaru.
And he's trying to have his, like, deep heart-to-heart as his brother's in the coma or in the back-to-tank or whatever the fuck that thing is. And it just this guy comes in and is like, hey, I'm part of the celebrity, comes in and fucking, you know, cheers up the hospital crowd thing. But he doesn't know any baseball stuff, so... He's not really that impressed, but then he realizes, oh shit, he's on the telly. He's actually kind of a big deal.
Yes. It also suggests that this is taking place in the present day.
Yeah. I mean, like, he's on the All-Star team on telly, so maybe it's just...
Yes. No, he would be, because he's like 47, the guy is.
Ah,
so.
Okay, fair
he's
enough.
He's a former baseball player now.
Yes.
Right.
I must recognize him because I had seen, it's a koala mascot from...
Yeah, Diwala.
That video you've shown before at Master of Agenza. It's like, oh, I know this guy. Well, no, his team is anyway. So, yeah, it makes it even more confusing because this is set in, like, the year 2000X, but it's probably, it's, you know, grim, dark present where there was only war.
I mean, like, that's this year, though, right?
Yeah. It's every year for the entire time you've been alive, Dwayne.
Yeah, pretty much. Except about the robots, so we're fucking missing out on that bit.
Well, are we? Are we missing out? I suspect we're not.
Nah, I mean, like, I've seen those fucking DARPA things that can jump about and do a dance and our dogs or something. Those are grand, but I'm talking like giant robots. Yeah. Giant space robots, that's what I'm after.
I feel like that is what's going on here, to be honest. Particularly when we get to the second half, when Beyond gets in a giant robot, which is far too giant.
Like, are you supposed to pilot that with a giant robot? You know, like a Gurren Lagann situation.
Yes.
I figure that's what's going to happen.
So, yes, he climbs
also, I can't
robot.
Figure out that if that guy is crazy or stupid, and probably both.
He's crazy enough that he doesn't notice that he's stupid. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So smart he doesn't realize he's a moron. That kind of...
He's stupid all the way around.
Yeah,
he's got the emotional capabilities of a toddler as well.
I love that bit at the end where initially, like, he bursts out of his cell, grabs the scientist, is like, I could kill you if I want, kind of thing. And then he's talking down to by the construction worker.
Yes.
What are you doing? The alien destroyed a boot down here in my lunch.
You can't tell you jumped in. Oh, this is a white space.
Don't cry. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. I realize I can risk. Come on. Give me the drink. Good. You know, get a drink out of the machine. What do you want? Do you want a coffee? You want the bean drink? Come on. Either one you want, it's
yours. Your choice, kid.
It's on me.
It's going to be okay. The first bit I was kind of like, that's a good one-note joke, but this fucking joke with your man was just, it kept rolling, like where he put himself in the crack in the seat and is like, oh, this is comfortable, just the right amount of pressure, and then looks at the audience, bet that's what you thought I was going to say. And I was like, what is happening here right now? dear.
Yeah, Hades Durandal, that's the thing he's climbed into that's far too big.
The prototype that hasn't been finished and literally still has construction workers inside it.
Good stuff all round. And moving on to... Where's my list? Let's know. Next on the list, it would be Golden Kamuy. Episode 17, Inside the Belly. In which we get another new character who survives this arc, unlike the new character we got last week, who gets shot in the head in this story.
I didn't expect that so fucking quickly, but it's this kind of show. Yeah.
Yes, so their plan seems to be going well until this new character shows up, whose name I've forgotten, but as I'm...
He's in the opening.
He's the messenger. Yeah, he's like Tsurumi's number one messenger. He's from Satsuma.
Oh, yeah, that dude.
He tries to catch out the guy disguised as the warden by talking to him in the dialect of his region. But the guy knows the dialect as well, so it seems to be everything's going great until he answers one question incorrectly. And
it wasn't even incorrect, it was slightly wrong. You could interpret that his answer of like, hey, do you still drink? And it's like, not as much as I used to. Whereas the answer is actually not at all anymore.
He's a teetotaler, blam, blam, violent.
And this new guy's got eyebrows, for sure.
Eyebrows for days.
here we go. Koito Otonoshin. That's the boy.
Yeah, like our master of disguise gets shot in the head straight away. But when Sugimoto's brilliant fucking disguise, when he gets shot in it, I was like, well, he'll be fine.
Yes, and Tsurumi sent him because he's got him on the phone, because he's like, oh, if the warden left the prison, we'd know. We've got guys, that's someone in disguise. And he's eating the phone as he's...
Yeah. showing that he's still
on it. Damn it.
His subordinate saying, it's like, you're a little too close to the receiver there.
But luckily they've got Immortal Sugimoto there. Even though he's been shot twice, he busts out there with Shirayashi.
Yeah,
saving
one time
Shirayashi
from death
at one point.
He takes a bullet for him, the second bullet. He gets shot in the chest twice as well, like fucking hell.
Yes. Yeah, because the Lieutenant Colonel at the base is mad that he's been deceived, and so despite the fact that Tsurumi wants Shirayashi alive, he's going to shoot Shirayashi out of pure anger, even though Shirayashi had nothing to do with this plan whatsoever.
And he specifically says, like, Tsurumi will get mad at you if you shoot Shirayashi. He wants this fucker. I thought, like, was the Sugimoto disguise thing like a front to distract them from the fact that this guy... Like, if you knew the guy, he doesn't look at all like the guy. He has the same countenance of his face, but...
Yeah, I think it's a...
it's a crazy guy whose face was bitten off, and it's just like, what a crazy
Yeah, it's a combat misdirect, I think.
I figured it was something like that.
And then, yeah, he's trying to appeal to the Lieutenant Colonel's greed by giving him these counterfeiting plates.
Yeah, and he nearly fucking has him, like... He's
but
so
somebody,
good at selling the con.
Somebody has to want to barrage in. It's like, oh man, this fucking guy. I got shamed that he was ready for him as well, but man, he had like 99% prepared for him. It's that last 1% that just undoes the whole thing. So, time to get out of there.
They got their backup with, what's your man's name? The sniper?
Ogata
is like giving them kind of backup and telling them which way to get out because he's seen which way the troops are moving towards all the fucking gunshots.
Yep, and we get our hot air balloon, which is I mentioned previously. I'm saying, oh, it's all planes nowadays. I'm saying, but it's still got a balloon, so I'm going to escape on that.
Yeah, it's also a good excuse why the men can't shoot at them because it's filled with fucking hydrogen.
Yes.
Yeah. So they're making human pyramids, trying to catch up to them and that kind of thing.
Yeah, they. I know comparing Red Dead Redemption 2 to this, I'm not alone, and you're. But the appearance of the balloon after I've just done the mission where a balloon appears in Red Dead Redemption 2.
It's kind of like of that kind of turn of the century kind of stuff. It's all those points you have to cover.
Yes.
Like, okay, someone has to get, like, a big machine gun. Someone has to do, like, a dirigible, that kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and so it ends up with Asurpa, Ogata, Sugimoto, and Shirayashi on this balloon. But there, first of all, there's a sword fight, because Koito manages to climb on the balloon as well.
He managed to, like Lupin, swim his way through the air to get that last few inches.
Yeah.
I did appreciate that, even though I was still, like, fucking reeling from your man just dying, like, straight away after being introduced. And I was like, oh yeah, I forgot, this is, like, a shitload of comedy in this show as well.
Boy, it looks like he's around for a long time after this, because his wiki page is very long.
Oh, I was enjoying him in this episode, so that's
yes,
good.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's got his gimmick, and the guy keeps it up.
His gimmick appears to be that he doesn't want Tsurumi to yell at him.
Yes.
Tsurumi to yell at him.
Yeah. Also, when he's annoyed, he talks like super fast in Satsuma dialect.
Yeah.
And no one can understand him. Yeah.
Yes, he ends up falling from the balloon when Shirayashi bungee jumps.
That was a pretty badass move, but then obviously he looked immediately like an asshole when he got pushed through a tree. And a Usurper looked like a badass, like riding him like some sort of upside down climbing frame. that was pretty good.
And then they're headed into the mountains, and a Usurper gives them a tale about the particular Kamui which dwell here. They're sex demons. They cause you to take your clothes off and go mad.
Mm.
And which Shira actually laughs at that, and you, the reader or the viewer, know.
Well, that's happened to him.
That's happening.
It's at least happening him, if it's not happening fucking
he's
everyone.
He's getting hyperthermia, and he's going to take his claws off.
I almost expected an immediate hard cut to him naked.
It set it up that fucking well, I think, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't even question it. You wouldn't even, they'd be just like, of course. Of fucking course, that's what would happen.
So he does that. He runs off. A serpent chases after him, but he actually had doubled back round and was now lying between two dead deer that he'd killed for warmth. Yeah. And so Sugimoto has to go and find a Serpa.
Hmm. And they can't make it back, so he has to kill another deer, and he's slightly unwilling to kill a deer because the last time he was like, oh, but that guy was like me, that deer.
Now this is about survival. Gotta take care of this kid.
After all the extreme action and the comedy of this episode, I did not expect like the heartfelt talking about war and coming back from it like broken and everything at the end of this.
Yes.
Yeah.
It kind of took me aback. It was unexpected, but really nice.
Yeah, and he also thinks that Shirai. I don't know whether he's saying that for Shirayashi's benefit. Saying that Shirayashi have given. What's his face? I forget his name now. Because he wasn't in the episode.
Hijikata
a fake.
Yeah.
Or because it's quite clear that Shirayashi wasn't giving him a fake, so is he pretending that they were fake for Shirayashi's benefit?
I don't know, because Shirayashi's reacting to that. He's kind of like, oh, yeah, totally. I was on your side the whole time. And he's like sweating buckets. It's like, wait, what?
Or was he just terrible at making copies?
Yeah. Also, he doesn't mind throwing away a copy of the original anyway.
See, so. You don't know, like, because it's Shirayashi. He was like the kind of bumbling comic relief character, but you don't want to believe, maybe he does have this side to him where he's only out for himself. And you don't want to, like, conscience that, but maybe you kind of make up these little things for yourself to try and as a comfort. But actually, no, maybe he might be a dickhead. He might be a comic relief guy. He could be a dickhead as well.
It does fit into like Sugimoto's thing at the end, where it's like you have to kind of put yourself away in a war, and you don't come back the same. And maybe some people can come back and they can reconnect with their family or their home and become the same people again. And maybe he wants that. Like, he doesn't want to kill Shirayashi, like, so he's giving him this out. It's like, oh, yeah, you totally faked it for us, right, buddy? It's like, I did. And it's like, if he fucks over Sugimoto again, I doubt he'll give him the same kind of out. But this is him giving him a chance to go, I'm going to forgive you in this thing, even though I've specifically said if you betray once, you're likely to do it again. It's kind of like that humanizing speech he gets at the end between him and Usurpa.
I'm trying to remember, is there like a myth or a fairy tale about eating persimmons in Japan? Or is it just another anime used it as imagery?
Because there's a lot of like fairy tales involving like eating fruit of various kinds.
Persimmons.
I can't think of one of that
proper. Yeah. Well, we get like persimmon seeds, you're supposed to be able to kind of throw them in to predict the weather.
Be like a kid, because obviously we see young Sugimoto, his friend, and his was it his friend's wife or fiance? I've forgotten actually. When they were young, prior to the war, that kind of thing. They're maybe the persimmons is kind of like a kid treat, so it's kind of like this callback to innocence.
Yeah,
there were some weird story jumps as well, which makes me think they're editing scenes out again.
Yeah. Just making it work for the 25 minutes or so. Yeah.
Yeah, I think. Well, I think it's not so much making it work for the 25 minutes; it's making it work for the 24 episodes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. For
they can get to the prison stuff before. before the series ends.
Yeah, I imagine that there was probably a lot more going on in that chase across the mountains, and for suddenly, we just crashed the balloon and they're already on top of us. I thought they were like miles behind us, but they're already here. I don't know.
Oh, I saw them coming on horses. They'll totally find us. Yeah,
and this was also felt like an episode where they remembered, we better do some wildlife drawing.
They didn't get any food.
Trail.
Yeah, they didn't get any food stuff in this episode, so they have to get some animals in, of course.
Well, no, she ate the livers.
Manage to sneak in eating his liver and saying that she will eat its brain later, yeah.
And then Superman goes, you really like brains, don't you?
like it's a cute thing. Not a weird, specific thing she likes eating.
Yeah.
Not a weird thing you shouldn't be eating as well, but but there you go, they didn't know about elements of food science back in those days.
Maybe it's just tasty. I mean, like, you know, even if it's bad for you, it just might be tasty. I'm not going to try it, though. I'm not going to eat a sparrow's brain. No thanks.
anyway, that was that episode. It was
It's Golden Kamuy.
Yeah, it's Golden Kamuy.
You did stay for after the credits, right?
Did I stay for after the credits? I can't remember. What happened after the credits?
There's a shot of Shirishi that just made me laugh for like fucking a few minutes after the end of it.
All right, then.
I'd go back and do it, yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
That goes for you too, listener.
Yes. Righty-ho, then we've got, next on the docket is Thunderbolt Fantasy Sword Seekers 2, episode.
Did you discuss it last time?
No, because I've not got up.
Okay, well, let's roll in episodes 5 and episode 5, Hellfire Revival, episode 6, A Poisoner's Pride. Pretty much episode 5 was... So we got from Shane Buhan is in the cave while like the Hunter Fox, he's got a name, but it's kind of named Hunter Fox. He's off the posse, including the prisoner crew, trying to find him. He's like, shit, I hope those guys get back here soon because it's hard to concentrate. If I sit for a moment, the poison's going to get into my system and it's going to kill me. So I better go back here soon. Meanwhile, the lads, they've encountered the dragon in Hellfire Valley, whose horn they're trying to cut off to make the antidote to the venomous affecting Shane Buhan. And I meant to investigate closer whether it was the case, but it does appear the dragon doesn't seem to be a dude in a suit. It's either that or a very elaborate puppetry. But I believe, yes, it's a guy in a suit in the opening credits, so I want to believe it's the same thing here.
Right.
And they're getting pretty well messed around by this dude. And... not helped by Lin Setsu kind of constantly goading the dragonborn saying, oh, well, sure, just give us the horn. I mean, you obviously lost the wind. The other guy was a little horn going, but saying, we motherfuckers come along here, chop me up. Like, if I came along and say, well, I'd like, you know, you'd fun, chop off your head and give it to me, would you do it? Probably not, so fuck off. Boo, breed fire. And it's like, oh, crap, we're in a tight spot here. Okay, Lang, you don't talk too much. I know that because you got some kind of enchanted sonorous voice. You're kind of like Black Bolt or some shit, or... your real power lies in your voice, so you don't use it too often because it could be like lethal to anybody who isn't able to handle it. So you go up onto that rock and start doing like fucking rock and roll powers at him, start wailing on the Biwa there and fighting him off because he's using fire breath. So by my logic, if you use your own breath, i.e., your cool musical power voice, it should be able to threaten long enough for me to get in there and get a hold of him. So they
it's a
do
lot
that.
Of assumptions. Okay.
So they do that, and actually, like, Lang is up on the rock. He starts wailing the Biwa with rock power, and manages to collapse a rock onto the dragon, and he's still alive. But fucking Lin Setsu's back and says, "Oh, well, I see you pretty much in this boat. I'll like take my little chunk of horn here, and I'm out of here." Fun said, "You dirty rats! I'll get you as long as I live." So we might see the dragon again. I hope so. It's a pretty good suit. But they're not. A minute away from the scene when Lang starts attacking Lin Setsu. It's like, whoa, what the fuck's going on here? Talking about our buddies. Everyone's saying, you are a bad guy. With Shan Buhan, he's at the way he talks about you. I know you're a bad guy because you just like steal stuff. And I am a good guy, so I gotta fight you. Everyone said, no, for fuck's sake. Lin Setsu's kind of going, this dude is loyalty, his one morality is all like one black and white. He has no idea what the grey areas are. Sure, I'm a thief. I fuck people over. But I do it for all a good cause mostly. So it's just for fun, but I'll do it anyway. I was like, well, that's the way you're going to be. I'll just type twist boomerang, call one of those like demon birds and fly out of here. Okay. Now remember, you got the hard part. You just get the rest of the antidote at down the market and just grind it together and give it to him. I'll see you later. Bye. He's like, shit. Okay. Meanwhile, like the feds... the posse, they've caught up Shane Buhan. He's trying to escape, but you know he's incapacitated due to the venom running through his veins. He's trying to fire out the guys, but it's not working out at all. And I think they got him. When Hunter Fox and all those guys come and say, "Ah, the mighty Shane Buhan, how the mighty fall! Ha ha, we got you now." But then Lang comes along nick of time and throws in the antidote. And he just gets fucking powered up. The song kicks in. Land is cloaked in deepest blue. The shadows of eagles across the moon. It's like, well, do you feel better, Shan Buhan? I feel great. And he starts kicking ass, which leads into the back for the episode 6 is A Poisoner's Pride. And Hunter Fox is like saying, "Oh, and Shang Fu Han, you're a criminal brought to justice. You will pay for your crimes, and then you go come with me, and I'm going to be like the top cop in knife." And say, "I don't give a shit about the fucking what you are. You're just some guy." like, he's trying to have his like triumphant villain victory speech over him, but he, like Shang Fu Han saying, "Nah, I don't give a fuck about this. I don't care." And he's like, "Whoa, oh, I'm so pissed off with you. Everybody, all the boys, get him." And Princess Cruelty starts having a go at him. With Shang Bohan, he's fun back. He's in top form now, and he's just kicking her ass. It's a pretty class fight, actually. Sort of back and forth. And she's having conniptions because it's like, "That poison that I made especially to kill you, how the fuck did you cure yourself from it? It's no!" She's like, this complete insult to her pride as a poisoner, as somebody who does that kind of thing. Mm. Like, "You're supposed to be dead, you're supposed to die!" But I'm saying, "Yeah, well, I didn't. I'm also better at throwing at you. Kapow! Nah, fuck!" She runs off into the wilds. The other guys go away with tails between their legs. And Shang Buhan and Lang attempt to give chase. But that mysterious monk shows up again. He is the dude who came along. He cured the head of the... not the fucking deity. The guys whose job it is to make sure the swords are safe, but the bad at it.
The archive or whatever it was called. Yeah, yeah.
And he was a guy who used chi power to cure the old beauty dude head of that thing. And he also had a little run-in before in a barn with Princess of Cruelty when this a few episodes back when she tried to kill him. But it's like, "Why are you trying to kill me?" "Ah, because I'm the Princess of Cruelty, is what I do." "Yeah, but it's not a good reason to take a life." And he's kind of doing complete like martial arts matches, one like dodging or throwing blows, just like swaying in and out. And he just goes off in his merry way, and saying, "Well, if you can't think of a good reason to beat me, then you're never going to beat me. You're going to kill me. So you better like think about that for a little while." And that's kind of giving her some pause at all as well. Anyways, he shows up again, and he's like, "Hey, do you see like a woman running by here?" And saying, "Why?" "Because we're after her." And saying, "Oh, you're trying to kill her?" "Yeah, but she's a bad guy." "Yeah, but you're trying to kill her. But why do you want to kill her for?" And someone saying, "Well, she's a bad guy." "That's not a good reason. So I'm not going to tell you where she's going to go." And then Lang tries to attack him. Shang Bohan points saying, whoa, "This guy, he's just being, he's just not getting any more fights. Let's just let him go his way. Don't mind this monk. You go off, do your thing." But Ling, the B.Y., is the voice of reason for saying, "That guy is dangerous. He's fucking dangerous." And we probably were right to try and stop him right then and there, because he sees no value in human life at all. Like, you know, never mind his own life. He doesn't see any meaning to life at all. So why would he have any kind of pity or mercy on anybody else? Because if human life is meaningless, then he would have no qualms about killing anybody across his path. Wouldn't you agree? It's like, I don't know. Let's just get back to trying to track down Princess of Cruelty and get the swords back, right? I'm not having a lot of time for any of this like highfalutin philosophy stuff right now. And at the end there, in the middle of that previous encounter, Lin Tetsu showed up to him and saying, "Ah, I am here. I'm Officer Chad Sexington, here to help you arrest Shang Buhan. But as you can see, he's back to full power. So, Hunter Fox, I think it's in our best interest to retreat right now. Wink, 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 Shang Buhan, and like, you will let the criminal go free." And Shang Buhan's like, "What the fuck's going on here? Was it any man of Gale what with me? I'll take my leave. You guys better watch out next time." But when Hunter Fox gets back to base, he's like, I'm just going to take a break for a while, gather our forces. "Might I ask you, Chief of Police, I've heard of this guy, the Enigmatic Gale?" And it's like, the guy's like, "Whoa, what the fuck? Where did you hear that name?" "Oh, I had heard it. Oh, well, we're trying to pursue those criminals, and this name has came up in the course of my investigation." And I'm saying, "Oh, that's that fucking guy. He's like the worst criminal that has ever like encountered in this country. You better watch your back for cross paths of that guy." And Hunter Fox is like, "Is that so? Very interesting." I must have a close look. I don't know who this Chad Sexington really is. And obviously he's going to try and uncover his thing and show me actually the cop he appears to be. yeah, it's just kind of really kind of fun stuff. As it's an absolutely class fight when Shang Bu-han gets cured of the poison. He just starts kicking ass, and there was some great choreography, great effects going on there. They're trying to like, inject a little bit of stuff in there, but that monk and saying, "Oh, what is the meaning of life? Life is no meaning." Yada yada. Everyone saying, "Nah, well, this is like trying to like, give like a veneer of integrity and deeper meaning to this otherwise kind of fun martial arts romp." So don't need to worry about it. Just come here for the fights and have a lot of fun. That's what it's all about, really, for me. It's good stuff. It's fun. I hope I see the dragon guy in the suit. I want to see some more interaction with the puppets and how they can pull it off. I think they can just do really fun things with that. But that'll be at some point later on in the series. So let's leave it at that for now.
Next up is... go to this page and see Jingai-san no Yome, Episode 6, Exchanging Rings.
I don't think we should try and do like time ourselves and see if we can do a recap in 3 minutes of what happened.
Well,
the show.
This was the very first thing I watched, and I'm struggling to remember.
So
exactly what happened.
There's a lot of problems with people faking that saying that they're married. So they gotta have like official documentation. And I think is it his teacher or his guidance fucking counselor suggests, is like, here, you can take these rings and go get fucking married and have a big ceremony, and then you'd have proof.
It's the woman who's arranging these marriages.
Okay.
For
yeah,
the monsters.
Yeah. I thought it was one of the school staff.
She works at the school, yes. I don't know
in
what
that capacity.
Yes.
Marrying children to monsters. That's my job in the school.
Yeah. There's a couple of characters I don't think we'll see in this series because they're not in the publicity material. So
yeah, we still haven't
hopefully
seen the
second
guy
series.
Who's married to those?
No, we'll get to them. Mm. Apparently, those two can speak, so you're getting a gradual increase in the amount of communication that the creatures can do.
Dear.
Yeah, but she seems mainly interested in doing this so she can take photos of the wedding.
Yeah, she just thinks it's super cute. She's a fan of the show. Yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah. And then they're at the wedding. He's enjoying it. The red-haired one asks if the bandage monster would like to have a wedding. And
he's imagining himself in, like, traditional Japanese kind of...
Oh, it's not... No, I thought it was him, and then I rewatched it, and it's her. Or I say her. I'm gendering bandages.
Yeah.
The bandages are thinking... about him in the traditional, and then think, and then brought out the sign saying Nightmare Bride.
okay. Oh, dear. Yeah, and he can't seem to figure out how
scared,
to put a ring
sorry,
on bandages. It was the other thing, yeah.
Nightmare Bride was the previous sign they brought out. It was I'm scared. Yes.
Yeah.
You generally get the feeling that that monster is not so much into this marriage.
Well, the bandage guy didn't pick him out. He picked the bandage monster. Yeah.
And then the other guy had given the pink ball a ring, but he thought the pink ball had lost it or eaten it or thrown it away, but it was just ended up attached to its strap on its
hat. Yeah, he said it's over. Like, oh, you left it there. Well, I mean, like, I tied it there, so I guess I forgot, that kind of thing.
And then the final punch, the final punchline is Kanonoge is still wandering around with the cans that are attached to it after the wedding. They're just married, but actually they're just handy snacks. Because as well as concrete, it eats cans as well.
So it's like some kind of super goat or something.
Yes.
Okay.
I think that's everything covered.
Yeah, I think that's most of it, yeah.
Very little more. Yeah, so apparently it's not just boys being married to monsters. There is a girl married to a monster later on in the series who won't be in this series.
Okay.
I believe she's married to like a giant snake. And then apparently there's a boy genius character shows up who ends up married to a tiny, tiny mermaid. And then another character is apparently there's a character who is jealous of Tamari being married to Kanogi-san and wants to steal Kanogi-san away from him. That is what I learned in my research for Jingai-san no Yome this week.
It's a show that I feel like never wants to explain itself and just is exactly what you see.
which means I'm hoping that they do a second series, but I'm not hoping it, holding out too much hope, because I don't think the director has done a second series of anything yet, but has technically had a good first series. But it may just be that there's not enough material yet, because it is a four-panel strip.
Right, so. Right.
I think there's like only 39 chapters of it so far.
Oh, okay.
Not 39 strips, but 39. Bunches of strips, which you can go and read. They're all because it's all on is because it's a web comic. You can easily go and have a look at it all.
Hmm.
Next up is Mr. Tonegawa's Middle Management Blues. Right, I'll go back and have another nap.
Well, sorry.
Dear. I every week I'm like, okay, maybe I'll not talk about it this week, but I'm like, oh shit, it was another good one, so I'm kind of fucked. Crap. I'm trying to think of the fucker's name. Tonegawa has been to the doctor, and he's gotten some bad test results. It's nothing serious, he's just gotten all C grades on all his blood sugar levels and all that kind of thing, which is, stands for, I think, caution or see me later kind of thing. He sort of has to have another checkup. He changes his lifestyle. He starts smoking e-cigarettes. He takes the bike to work when the weather allows it. He takes the stairs. He's drinking them weird green health shakes, that kind of thing. Yeah. And all the employees are kind of like, oh, fuck, do you think we should not, like, eat greasy food when he's around? Just, you know, just because it'll be a bit fucking mean, like... And I think it's... Ah, fuck, I can't remember his name. I think it's Doshita or something. It's the guy who's like the jock of the group. He apparently played rugby in school. He's like, oh, Tonegawa has not only inspired me, you guys aren't going far enough, I'm going to take his exact fucking regime. And so he's like following him on the bike and like going into the smoking area and electronic cigarette smoking. And he's copying him in every way, and it kind of gets more extreme where he's like following Tonegawa around and making him do shit. Like Tonegawa was like, you know, I've had it pretty good so far. I can probably afford to have this pretty like unhealthy lunch, but I've been good, and this is my little treat to myself for the thing. And your man just bursts into his office and throws it straight in the fucking bin, that kind of thing. And he's just like being really extreme and pushing Tonegawa too hard, to the point where Tonegawa has to like sneak his tonkatsu bento into the bathroom, and like, he's like, what the hell, I'm like a bullied child kind of thing. And then he like hears your man come like burst into the bathroom, he's like, I smell tonkatsu, and he's just checking all the stalls, and it's like a fucking horror movie. And he I think he allows him to eat the pork because it's a good vitamin a good source of vitamin B1 or something, but he doesn't allow him to eat the rice or any of the bread because it's full of fucking carbs. That's killer, man. Friggin' Tonegawa goes back to the dock. He's getting all A's. It really worked out, but his estimation of that guy has gone considerably down since. Part B. Otsuki is out on another fucking day trip because that's the point of his episodes. But another guy is out. It must be another guy from the slave mines. He doesn't recognize him, so he's probably just some fucking pleb who doesn't like gambling or drinking or doing all the cool stuff that he does. And he just probably randomly acquired the amount of money, didn't know what to do with it, and is just going to spend a day out. And he's like, probably going to do some boring crap. Ah, whatever. I'm going to go to my favorite fucking hole-in-the-wall kind of bistro that people don't know about and order my favorite cinnamon apple pie with milk tea. Mmm, very nice. And he goes there, and that motherfucker's there and has ordered that exact fucking thing. And he's like, shit, how the fuck did you know about this place? That's like the best thing on the menu as well. Like, yeah, maybe he kind of knows his shit. He goes to his next place. The guy's already there. He puts in his order, and then he sees that the guy has just been given that very specific order as well. So it's like, well, holy shit, these guys are syncing up entirely. I think they both go to the same McDonald's. They both go to they both get soft serve ice cream. And Otsuki realizes, this guy, we're simpatico. We got like the same exact tastes. There's nothing like this. And for a considerable portion of the episode, the commentator takes over and goes like, yes, they are perfectly in sync. Without it needing to exchange a word, they both realize that they both like exactly this kind of same food. They both go to the same hotel. They don't go to the same room now. Nothing fucking dirty. They wake up at the same time. They go out at the same time. They're just there's never been a perfect match like this, and they don't even need to speak or exchange a glance or anything. They're just in totally in sync. Except when they go out to their lunch the next day, where I think they ordered the minced tuna bowl with green onions. And they both order it at exactly the same time, in the same cadence and that kind of thing. And then your man says, can I get it with a chili bean sauce and a quail egg? And your man's like, the fuck? You don't fucking eat that shit with fucking chili bean sauce and a quail egg. But he sees your man eating and is like, he seems to be really enjoying it. Ah, fuck it. Can I get one quail egg as well? And chef brings him out a quail egg. And he's like, okay, I'll tap it on. I mean, like, I'm not going mad with the chili sauce or anything. Like, I can see how the quail egg would work. But then the guy looks over at him and slides over the chili sauce and kind of gives him a look sort of thing. It's like expecting him to take the jump. And he's like, fuck it, you only live once. He puts it on and it tastes amazing. It's perfect. And he has to compliment the guy, but he turns around when he finishes his meal to compliment. It's like, you fucking know your shit, my friend. And the guy's already gone. He goes out the door. He's been taken in the black car back to the slave mines.
Oh.
And his car is also pulled up and it's like, hey, Otsuki, it's time to go back to the slave mines too. And he's like, oh man. And then he's wandering around for days and it's like, Otsuki's never going to see him again. And he's like, the foreman, you got to help us out. And he's just off in a fucking, in a daze. It's like, man, I don't know what to do. I've never had that before. And it's lost now. I never even got his name. And he's passing by a guy pushing a cart wearing one of those masks. He's like, excuse me, have we met somewhere before? And the guy pulls down the mask and then he says, your name. And then it does a parody of your name. and the episode ends. And I was just like, fucking hell, that was brilliant. I fucking love his sections now. They're fucking amazing.
Oh,
this show is so stupid and I love it.
I'm guessing that has the advantage of those sections have been written, the comic has been written very recently.
Yeah, no, definitely.
I wonder how they're trying to like, do their civic duty, whatever. They have all the kind of food episodes, was like him getting all the greasy, like, going to the greasy spoon and getting all the kind of tasty stuff he missed and that. And then, gotta do our civic duty in the show, like, have our other characters trying to eat rice and be healthy and do that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's like we're probably encouraging a lot of fucking bad habits and we gotta show that is not a sustainable way of living.
Don't gamble.
It could be that, yeah.
Don't get like tossed in the slave mine where like the vapors are kind of the dust from the rocks you're breaking is going to give you like serious lung damage.
Like, if it wasn't for the fact that at the start of every episode he's just come from the slave mine, at the end of every one of his episodes he's going back to the slave mine. But, like, if it wasn't for that, it's just a guy having a nice day. It's just the implication at the start and end of that make it fucking kind of horrible. But other than that, it's just like, I think I'll have a nice, relaxed day. I'll go down and have a hamburger. That kind of thing. It's all super nice up to the context of it.
The other thing I'm curious about is, if you watch this, can you then tell the difference between the black suits when you go back and watch Kaiju?
God, that would be
fucking
amazing.
Can you then go and see?
Can you identify specific guys in black suits? That would be amazing. I should have mentioned the other three guys have been eliminated from the intro. So there's only their pictures are stamped out and they're just missing from the boardroom scenes and all that kind of thing in the intro. So we're slowly like cutting them back, and I think we're eventually going to find out who that woman in black is, because his team's getting really cut down. She's got to come in as a replacement at some stage.
Next on the list is Zombieland Saga, Episode 6, because it's Sentimental Saga, in which we get all sorts of information, but not really the information we thought we were going to start getting last week. The journalists are still part of the story. In fact, it opens with them. But they seem... We don't seem to get a clue yet as to exactly what the older journalist suspects.
Like, he could, like, so far it seemed like he could be just interested in them as idols.
Yeah,
hey, there's this
hot new band on the off.
Yeah, let's cover their rise and that kind of thing. Yeah,
and there's a running gag throughout the episode about how terrible and dated their website is.
Oh, like it makes me think that your man is a zombie, because it's like all these fucking t-shirt designs are designed in Microsoft Word. That fucking website was designed in some fucking really old thing.
It's like a GeoCities site.
Yeah, exactly.
They better change hosting, because they're closing all that shit down soon.
I did like the reporter going like, I think it's old-fashioned and cute. You know, it's like, that's because you're an old motherfucker.
But the crux of the episode, and it is an interesting thing And it's kind of like, you know, having the characters be zombies is the way you can get to this thing
to
discuss.
Yeah, the difference between them.
Mm. Yeah, is the difference between Idols in 2008 and Idols in the 80s.
Yeah.
Mm. And Idols in 2018. As I, who, that I is the one from Iron Frill from 2008, isn't she? Yeah, and Junko's the one from the 80s.
The solo one.
And they do like a meet and greet, and they're surprised they've got fans, and they're doing the pay to buy a piece of merchandise, you get to take a photo with a band member.
Yeah, you get to pick, that kind of thing.
And she, Junko, can't deal with this, because where she comes from, Idols they keep the fans well at arm's length, keep them away from it.
Yeah, you got to keep the mystique up, that kind of thing. Mm.
But also, their career, the Idols' careers in the 80s are longer and slower. It feels like a.
It's longer, it's slower, and you're supposed to be perfect from the get go. They didn't want to see your failures, but in the present day, it's more so they want to see you start off kind of crap, and they want to see you improve.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. No.
I was just saying, Junko kind of views it as well as like we should be doing this. We should be doing like this because we want to make our fans happy. We shouldn't be like doing like being what they demand us to be to kind of placate them. What we do, like our role in this, like what we're doing right now, singing and going down a stroll, it should be making them happy. Like just as the effect of it. We kind of start one way, and then the fans say we want to do this, and then them do that. That constantly kind of changing and updating at their whims.
It's the difference of like which way do you play to your audience? Do you try and sell them an ideal that is your own and your own voice and your own kind of thing that you're trying to sell, or do you try to appease them and do the thing that they want and do the current
thing? Do you tell them what they want to hear?
It's the two kind of contrary ways of doing that kind of doing art, clashing heads at it.
Junko feels that's disingenuous, but I is like, that's just a game, man. That's just how it was when I was an idol.
Like she feels it's disingenuous, but the way she says it sounds really fucking pretentious as well. So there's good and bad to both.
She doesn't seem like, yo, like, I'm above this. And she's like, what the fuck? And I was like, I fucking clawed my way up, like, climbing the ranks, from busting my hump, trying to get, like, far enough in this. And it's a game, man. It is a game. Mm. That's she's being more kind of pragmatic about it. But you can understand where she's coming from as well. She had to fucking bust her hump to get to where she got to.
Yeah, and then to get taken out as she did.
Yeah, but the other thing is, I also discovers that lots of the bands in 2008 who she thought were going to be big burnt out really quickly.
Yeah, probably because they were too much of a flash in the pan kind of thing, too much appeasing the fans. That her idea of what makes you popular isn't what makes you popular now.
I think it's just the idol business now. It's a churn, is what it is.
Yes.
As opposed to what it was in the 80s.
Hmm.
But her band, Iron Frill, is still going, and then we get to like the jux of we actually learn how one of these other people died.
And that they remember it, which is interesting. Yeah.
It's all up on the internet.
She read the post-mortems and the fucking breaking down of her career after the fact, but she remembers dying because she's afraid of the flashing lights and everything.
Yeah.
Mm.
But I kind of wonder now, did her looking up her own death, did that trigger that memory?
Okay.
In a way, I suppose, could they all do this? Could they all just go to, like genealogy.com and maybe find where their lifeline got cut off?
She's just the one who's most internet savvy based off when she died, because you did have the old one going like, wow, what's this magic box do? I just fucking go with the flow. I don't fucking know any of this shit.
it's like saying, if you get confused with things all the time, it just makes things more complicated. So I just say whatever. I was happy to be here, honestly.
Yeah, happy to be undead.
And there's like a throwaway gag in the background when you see how she's posing with people.
Yeah.
The photos to be taken.
You're like, hey, big boy, come to me after the show.
If anything, it's probably an improvement to whatever her lot was in the 19th century.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's kind of Saki, isn't it? The biker gang leader. Yes, and the leader of the group. She tries to deal with it by, can't you just agree that you're both right and you're both wrong at the same time and stop arguing? And then, but then Sakura goes to have a heart-to-heart with Junko and Saki has a heart-to-heart with Ai. And you do kind of get the... Saki explains that she doesn't really understand idols at all, or being an idol, but she just wants to do the best. And she works well as the band leader in this situation.
Yeah, it initially seems like she doesn't seem to know how to handle the situation, but her method and her way of just taking charge seems to actually help as a leader.
Yes. Yeah. And the setup is also from her at the start of the episode of wanting to... We should be part of this saga rock, because I love rock music. And it'd be great to have, like, 10,000 people perform in front of us. But it turns out Iron Frill are going to be performing there, so when they learn that they're going to be performing at saga rock, the two girls who the focus has been on are still... You don't know where their heart is, because, like, one can perform in front of that amount of people, but she's uneasy because her old group will be there, the group that she died on stage as part of. And Junko's uneasy because she doesn't feel that they're ready to be performing in front of that big an audience, whereas I's like, no, that's part of the thing nowadays, is the fans don't mind you failing in front of a big... That's part of the appeal, is seeing you get better performance by performance.
Yeah, her thing was like her trying to represent this ideal of perfection, whereas the more modern idea is to see those kind of human failings and everything, and because it makes you more relatable. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think Lily makes a point that she's like, she hasn't like performed in front of that amount of people, but she's appeared in front of that amount of people.
Yeah.
In her previous life, and as you say, Yugiri just goes with the flow. There's also a repeated gag of Kotaro running out of his shampoo and Tai finding various replacements.
Well, she's basically running interference while they're up on the computer and they shouldn't be.
Yeah. She is helping, weirdly enough. She is, like, it's weird to me because it's like, yeah, no, that's actually being super fucking helpful right now. Did the dog suggest the soy sauce? Because I feel like that dog wants to eat him.
Maybe.
Yes.
Also, I get the impression that a lot of the fans who came to see Ren Shushu may have come to see Tai, because that's a girl from the commercial. Do the line. Yeah, that's a line.
Yeah. No, they're happy to be there, but yeah, they're very into that.
Yeah.
I can almost see the ending being that somehow the others get restored to their humanity, but don't remain idols, and yet Tai is, like, still... goes and has a successful solo career while never stopping being a zombie.
Yeah,
idol and fried chicken spokeswoman. Legendary Italian man. it's a fun, good old show, this, though. Like, and I haven't seen a lot of idol anime, or at least not many of them, but I appreciate the sort of the mean streak this has.
It's like the
internal friction there between Junko and I, and like I is like one saying, well, it's just the way it is, man. But I would know, because I was like doing A, B, and C back in my day. And then Junko's like, well, you're not exactly up to date right now, are you? And I was just like, ooh.
Yeah, like I guess I could be annoyed at the show for fucking tricking me into watching an idol show, but it's also like a breaking down of those various tropes. Like, I can totally see how someone wouldn't want to watch this show because that manager is such a piece of shit when he's just screaming at them in the dungeon. But it's kind of like, yeah, this guy is another parody of that of idol fucking culture, of managers specifically, obviously.
Yeah. I threw it up as well because they mentioned that Joe Goshi died in a plane crash. I thought, plane crash in the 80s, and she was probably a passenger on Japan Airlines Flight 123, which crashed in 1985.
Okay, so that gives her date, rather than just saying Tamagotchi or something.
Wasn't her, but there was a famous singer who did perish in a plane crash, Kyu Sakamoto. Best known for the hit single Sukiyaki, as known in the Western world. It's like, okay.
It also thankfully rules out who I was worried it was going to be based on. Whose name I can't remember, but there was
A child,
when there was like a 80s idol who died young, I was like, oh, we're not going to do the one who committed suicide.
I feel like that'd be way too serious for this.
They're probably not going to go that dark, given that the first death you see is very slapstick.
Like, even the death of your one, which is tragic, it's still like, everyone in the audience is kind of like, the fuck? Because the odds of that happening are very low.
But Saki is like, that's badass.
That was fucking wrong.
I wish I got out that way.
Righto. Then we've got Karakuri Circus, Episode 5, Circus Departure. Well, that answers my question there, adapting it pretty much in the order of the comic.
Hmm.
In which the entire crux of the show changes entirely.
It's like the first episode of a different show, and I'm guessing, because that's what it kind of was for the comic as well. It was the introduction episode of the new fucking status quo,
Yes, for this half of the story.
Yeah.
We get a glimpse of the other half of the story at the end of this episode. We're going to turn you into part man, part puppet.
Our hero. We can rebuild him out of technology. He's a 12 million yen man. That's not a lot of money. Oh, it's fine.
It's wooden gears. It doesn't cost that much.
But yes, now it's a high school comedy about a kid and his maid who...
A kid who's been through some shit, but it's all right. And yeah, his maid slash sister slash, I don't know what the fuck, who everyone loves because she's awesome. And is a circus worker.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's true. The French thing is helping. But the fact that she's... Like, I love even the what do you call it? The Garou girls? Is that the right word?
Oh, the gals.
They're yeah. kind of like, hey, what the fuck, and then they're just like taken aback by her sincere deep apology, and they're all her biggest fans after that.
In the comic though, this is the thing, they've edited a bunch of stuff out of the comic from this bit. In the comic, he decided to let that evil uncle adopt him after all. Evil uncle is now no longer evil, and he's comically scared of Masaru.
That doesn't sound as bad, but no, fuck that guy. I would prefer him getting crushed by a building. That was better.
And the killer puppet squad are still his bodyguards.
Oh, they're still hanging around?
Yeah.
I kind of hope they're still there, because I did like that weird guy, that one slimy-looking motherfucker.
I presume it's still, like, there in the shadows, like, keeping an eye on things, and they'll just kind of, like, jump out when that part of the story develops further.
There's various hijinks at school as these kids continue to bully him, but he laughs it all off, because that's what he learnt from Narumi. And then he goes, basically says, well, I was going to have to admit next period anyway, because we've got sports.
Yeah.
So you'd have seen my body covered in scars.
That's some prison yard shit. We just want to taste off the top, and it's like, fuck it. It's like he has like the certain kind of tattoo that lets people or the other gangs know that one, don't touch this dude. But he was just like, you guys, he's putting the thumbtacks on my seat. No, you guys have no idea what real pain is. It's a massive scar tissue. It's like, what the fuck? This kid's probably going terrified. What happened to this gay man's holiday? Where did he go? He went to a fucking, I don't know, a Bangkok fucking hidden prison and got whipped and fucking got flogged for 2 months straight.
Yeah, he doesn't look great. And it's good to see that, like, obviously the literal and figurative scars are still there with him, but that he's choosing to live better. It kind of shows you that it's like, okay, he's good. He's probably going to be okay.
Meanwhile, Shirogane has bunked off school the entire day and spent it spying on Masaru.
Like threatening to murder bullies with a giant puppet.
Yes.
Or trying to, but she's going against her own advice. It's like, you can't stand out. You stand out, you get bullied. Like, I don't know, like that kind of fucking parent bullshit is just like, oh yeah, just fucking let the bullies do their thing and eventually they'll get sick of it. It's one of those stupid advices that don't work.
Yeah. Fuck's sake. Like, no, it's the alluring foreign student with the silver hair and silver eyes giving you advice for not standing out. The fucking girl is like, does like, a whole fucking gymnastics display and somersaults and dunks her whole body through the basketball hoop in front of a fucking roaring crowd.
Yeah, she somehow slam dunks her fucking or landing in her gymnastics routine. It's amazing, and everyone's just like, that's the most brilliant fucking thing. Yeah, obviously she's the belle of the school. Then after that.
Meanwhile, across town, we are introduced to three new characters. Shinobu Nakamichi, the head of the Nakamichi Circus, and his two sons, Nori and Hiro.
They haven't paid rent in a year, and yet have not been kicked out somehow.
Yes, their circus is apparently these office flats they're renting.
Mm.
I can't remember how does it get to Masaru going, Shirigani, you like the circus, you should go and join this circus.
I think it's basically when she, at the end of the day kind of thing, where she's like, oh yeah, I'm just going to like protect you forever and that's going to be my thing. And he's like, no, fucking, you like the circus. I know what this circus.
Please.
Yeah.
You need a hobby.
I assume next week we're getting something which leads to the pair of them running away with the circus.
Mm.
Otherwise, I don't think this episode is the show from now on. I feel like the episode is the bit with these two goofy brothers, faces alternating between overly bishonen drawings and lusty shonen faces.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
Well, I imagine they're going to join the circus, go on the road, and then they encounter the murder circus, and that sets off that part of the story.
Yeah.
I believe so, because I was looking at their names, and it's the next four characters on these next four actors have been named, and the next four characters after those guys are the four murder circus characters. One of which you'll be pleased to know is Joji Nakata.
Oh yeah, he's the guy with the long schmink.
Yeah, he's pantalone.
Good.
Yes, murderous Italian clowns. Or are they? Dun, dun, dun. Anyway, lots of this episode is even funnier once the secret of what is going on with certain characters is revealed. It's pretty funny as it was. It was pretty weird in that it's a complete detour from the seriousness of the last three episodes.
It feels like a pilot for a different comedy show. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And then we get the minor clue at the end of what's happened to Narumi is we see him in a hospital bed, and he appears to have had a new arm attached.
One with ruffles.
Tasty.
I believe it's slowed down a bit again in the adaptation, but I'm going to guess it's probably any chapters where there's a lot of action, that stuff's going to happen faster in the...
Yeah.
And the original author is co-writing the series, so I'm guessing he's also just casting aside bits he may not have done if he wrote it nowadays.
It's like, okay, that fucking thread didn't go anywhere, so I'm just going to write that out. It's like, oh yeah, I tried to do that, but it wasn't really working, so I dropped it.
Yes.
You probably don't need to see that uncle ever again, so...
Forget him.
Why?
Because, I mean, like, he didn't serve any other function in the plot after I left him in the plot. Yeah.
So that's basically, like, when it has these very sharp swirls like this, they think, oh... In case that guy's on the staff, I'm sure he knows his own material better than anybody else. We'll see where it takes us.
Right, then we've got Gurazeni, episode 18, Lonely Season. Almost another bottle episode. This time set in that
Chinese restaurant.
I guess it's set between the Chinese restaurant and the place where the pitchers train. I've forgotten they said the name of the fucking stadium where they train as well.
Yeah, they sent them because they're not part of the Japan series, so they're doing extra training, and as he's training, the various other pitchers he's training with are getting laid off. And
you know this guy's up for the chop because he's had, like, diminishing returns and he hasn't even been on this fucking season, that kind of thing.
And they finally let him know that they're going to trade him, and he's like, well, at least I'm going to carry on being paid what I'm being paid. I'm not a free agent. I don't have to go and find a new job.
I'm going to the Kobe team, and I'm fucking from there, so, I mean, like, it's not the worst fucking thing. And it, even at the end of it, it's so fucking bittersweet. I was just like, Jesus, man, that sucks.
Yeah,
they always put those coders in as if to say, this is what Vonda's up against. This is the fate that awaits him.
If you fucking if you don't go 100% every fucking day.
Pull your socks up, Ben.
Yeah.
So they go to the restaurant, and it turns out, of course, they're showing the Osaka Tempters game, and everybody in there is pretending to be a fan of the Osaka Tempters because they are also in love with the waitress.
I feel like that was to make Bonda seem less like a creepo in this, because, like, well, everyone in here is a creepo, so it's okay.
But no, he's worse. He's still the worst of all of them, because he's not saying anything. He's just creeping in silently. He's not. Can't even bring himself to talk to her.
I think I saw in the comments, like, your man did more for Bonda in this fucking night than he has done the entire year of coming to this restaurant.
Like, well, he just wants to think, like,
you had a conversation with her. You strike up a dialogue with them with your common interests, and you fucking talk to them like humans.
It's like, you guys come here and talk to people, senpai. What? No. Talk to her.
Like,
no.
He specifically has a line in his head where it's like, well, you know, they wouldn't have met it in if I hadn't fucking flubbed that throw and give them that run against us kind of thing. So you should thank me for your beloved Tempters being in. You haven't eaten fucking line. You're just like, oh, fuck, you know, fucking, if they wouldn't even have got there if it wasn't for me. It's like, what? Yeah, I'm fucking the pitcher for the thing. I really fucked up there, and they totally got us.
Yeah. You know, because the problem is, though, she knows who Bonda is. She doesn't know that he's... Because remember the hatred she has for Bonda from the last season.
Like, I think it dissipates when she's watching her Tempters and shit.
Yeah,
and
it's just a good while ago, though. I'd say she'd probably just be that way now.
Yeah. And your man's talking about, like, oh, yeah, I like the Tempters, but, you know, I like another thing. And, like, he's striking up the similar likes that they have, but that doesn't mean he has to like all exactly the same things. He's having a human conversation with her.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, then, like, she just says to the bad one, saying, oh, do you hear that one? Saying, yeah, I do. Oh my god, she's talking to me. She said something to me.
Yeah.
I'm a princess, you're all mad.
Because, I mean, like, your man gave him an in. It's like, oh man, fucking, that stadium's amazing. I mean, like, you know what it's like pitching there, right, Bonda? And he's like, I'm not a pitcher. What? No way.
But he wasn't giving him an in. He was doing it because he knew it would embarrass.
Yeah, he did it to embarrass him, but it was also a fucking in, is what I'm saying.
You say that whole thing about, oh, Bonda has it at the line of, oh, yeah, to the pitch, Buffalo pitch a fun guy into the thing. Like, he says that, and that's the kind of line you would apply, oh, is it kind of a funny little joke, a little meat cute, but he probably feels serious about it.
He does.
yeah, that's the thing. Like, if he played it easy and just went, it's like, yeah, I still respect them. Like, they totally met our, they totally beat our, all our friggin' batters in the end, that kind of thing. If he'd done that, he would have been fine. You know, just played it soft rather than just have these things that, like, even your man later on is like, oh, but you're still on your contract and everything. It's like, Bonda, stop talking about fucking money for 5 goddamn minutes, taking everything so seriously.
Then not only does he wind up Bonda at the end, he winds up all the other men in the restaurant.
Everyone out and kicking her heart.
Yes, flirting with her, and then quickly running out the shop. After that.
Like they were going to chase him or anything, yeah. Like a child, basically. It was pretty funny.
I think he just didn't want to embarrass her anymore than he needed to make the joke work.
Yeah.
And Bonner's like, everyone, I can never come here again. You realize that, right? You ruined my life. But he did it for... his last little night in the town before he has to move, because he might love the Tempters, but he loves one team even more, the Jingu Spiders.
And the Cody at the end is like, yep, he never played the whole season, and then he fucking retired. And I was like, fuck you, show. Fucking, why are you trying to make me feel bad for this guy, who I don't even know? This is the first episode I've seen him in.
It was all right, because Bonda is like, hey, man, you want to go get another pint somewhere? And he's like, that just sounds pretty good, Bonda. let's go grab another.
Yeah, because he didn't even want to go out drinking in the first place. Bond had just convinced him to get a bite to eat.
Yeah, I do think it, as much as I like the episode, and I was that bit at the end, it is a decent emotional beat. I just wish it was matched in the direction of the actual show.
Like you said, I get what they're trying to do. These are the fucking stakes Bond is up against. He could be any one of these guys if he fucks up. But goddamn, it's quite a whiplash, yeah.
Yeah, this is the directions a bit. So that bit where he's walking away into the night is like, I was like, oh, this
the sad
scene
walking
should,
away scene. Yeah.
Yeah, should have played a lot more emotional than it does because it just looks really flat.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Maybe don't play like the very upbeat opening theme song over there.
No,
otherwise you'd be fucking depressed after watching this show, man.
No, if I had my brothers, they'd play that constantly, in a, just lightly in the background throughout the entire episode, because it's a really good song.
Or it has some kind of, like, you know...
like a sad version of it.
Just on piano, nothing else.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably like Kitaro's got a version of its theme song for every occasion.
The action version, the emotional version, yeah.
On to Bonobono, episode 32, about Minibugs. In which it does not lie, it is all about Minibugs.
Minibugs are about everywhere.
They're about everywhere. When there's not many of them about, Raccoon thinks they're tasty. When there's too many of them about, their appeal disappears.
They're only appealing when they're in limited quantity, so it's about both... economy,
supply and demand.
I feel like there's an ecology thing going on as well, right?
It is. I didn't think this was a great episode.
There wasn't as many jokes, or at least not.
Yeah, that
like
was the
spot.
Main thing.
Yeah.
It was like it didn't have the joke density. I'd like all the scratching your head, wondering, this is a children's show. What on earth? Either like the weirdness of a giant rock up a tree, or the putaway man, or dealing with some sort of existential dread, but with funny animals.
I did enjoy the joke of Raccoon trying to see if he could explain worry to the Minibugs by drawing a Minibug with the sweat beads.
Yes,
and it's like, see, they don't have a fucking clue.
There is a good like thing I was screenshotting this deploy whenever I see something online that exasperates me. When like Raccoon is trying to count them all, but then his eyes got tired. It's just a screenshot of him, like with someone four finger against his head, and he's just like going, "Oh, grimacing." That's one. That's one to keep for the old reaction folder.
Okay.
Him drawing the Minibug with the sweat made me remember that time in Acker when the cop. He gets the same sweat beads from the Bonobono sweat beads.
Oh shit! Yeah.
Anyway, that was Bonobono. It was all about Minibugs.
Mm.
On to what's it called? I'm gonna guess at this point we should probably call it Samurai Cyber. What's it called?
Superhuman Samurai Cyber Squad. Good man.
That is because I'm pretty sure. I feel like by the end of this, there'll be no question that is exactly what those S's stand for. And it will be important that they stand for that.
Yeah, it won't just be a distracting Transformers reference that takes me out of it again.
It's also that.
It's also that, but I don't think that's the main plot. I think that's just there to make, to like go like, I'm getting into the scene. Oh, what the fuck? Is that the Matrix of fucking leadership? Son of a bitch.
Thankfully, like I said, my Transformers fandom ended somewhere during the UK.
Dude, I Emily was sitting beside me. She wasn't even watching it, and she just kind of looked up and she basically exclaimed that, and I was like, "Yep, it sure fucking is."
It's been in the intro sequence all this time.
I know, but like to see it just big up in the screen, in your face, fucking camera focusing on it all of a sudden, and I was like, "Does this? Like, what's the significance of this purse out in the gold Transformers reference?" I kind of forgot.
I bought a fucking school bag which has till all or none, which is some like phrase of like an evil Optimus Prime, some other alternate thing, isn't it?
Yeah, the girl whose sound wave has a towel that has a picture of a cat with the word fucking ravage on it. So It's very distracting. But other than that, yeah, good show.
There's other references too. I think when
there's a million goddamn references, dude.
We see when Rick she's like going about her day about town. She goes to like the music shop. She's listening to Inferno Cop soundtrack.
Yes.
shit, you got to get that tie-in, yeah.
But the entire episode is episode 6, and it is a big reference to episode 6 of Gridman.
I did enjoy the self-referential thing where they have the other characters talk about it. It's like, well, there's got to be kaiju in it because it's a show about kaiju. And if you don't have an episode about kaiju, it's not a fucking proper episode. Which, while the episode does have kaiju, none of them go into giant monsters. Yeah.
No. Yeah, so this is the episode. I guess we're halfway through, so now it's time for our main character to learn some truths.
Yeah.
And for the viewers to learn some truths as well. Probably maybe one more truth than our hero learns. Mm. So, yeah, it's... Akane sends Anti after Yuta, telling him that Yuta's Gridman, so just go and kill the Yuta.
Yeah, if you want to defeat Gridman, just kill that guy, because he's Gridman. And he's like, oh, brilliant, that'll totally work out for me. But he obviously can't find one person in this entire town.
He runs into Rika. In the meantime, Yuta has run into another homeless child.
A homeless kaiju.
Yes. Mm. Who explains that she's a kaiju by growing to a massive size.
And not really threatening him. Cause it's basically like asking him out for a conversation. But
the scenes are mirrors. All the scenes are mirrors.
Yeah.
Because you've got three dates happening at the same time.
That's right, yeah.
And three different people teaching, feeding each other. It's like Rika's not, she's not going too deeply into Anti. She's like, recognizes that there's something.
He must have some troubled home life. I'm not going to fucking question it. I'm just going to help out where I fucking can.
Yes.
Like, if you didn't figure out it was a mirror, you definitely would from the three guys following them around going like, at various circumstances. Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yes, because they leave what's his face at the shop guiding it again.
And the mother's giving out. It was like when he says, "Yeah, I got the day off today." It's like, you motherfuckers ever have a day on? Like
the one who's a jet. Did they even leave him there?
Yes,
I forget what his name is.
Vit. Yes. So yeah, Samurai Calibers following Rika as he tends to do. Max is following Yuta, and Boar is following Atsumi. Mm. So Atsumi's out with Akane's trying to find out from him whether Yuta is Gridman for sure.
I thought there was an interesting contrast when the kaiju's explaining, like, everything in this world is for her benefit, or if she doesn't like it, she destroys it, but she's taking that guy out for his benefit. She can see this is everything he ever wanted.
Yeah.
To have a conversation and to get on with the girl he really fancies. But as soon as she starts mining him directly for questions, he's kind of shutting down.
I think it's also kind of maybe what she wants as well.
Yeah, yeah.
A little bit
of the other things that the other kaiju is saying about how lonely her heart is.
Yeah.
Mm.
That the world is like very artificial to her. She doesn't make these connections and just eliminates things that slightly annoy her. So, yeah.
But yeah, the most obvious mirror is you got Rika feeding exactly the same buns to Anti as the other kaiju is feeding to Yuta.
They're a very popular sandwich.
Both in the park.
Same bench as well.
Yes. But yeah, so the kaiju invites Yuta to take... They're going to take a train ride outside the city where she will show him that there is nothing outside the city. Like we just went outside the city. That's not there.
I love the sign after the scene because it has the sign of the city's name, and to the left and right it goes to this city. And I was like, "Fuck, that's pretty crazy."
So you think you go somewhere, but you feel sleepy because it's like loading the next area.
Yes, it's exactly loading the next area. I think is the idea.
Yes, yeah. And she explains this with. She wakes him up using sounds.
Using music, because that... I forget her explanation, but it was really interesting, yeah.
Oh, it's what she is like a callback or probably the same thing as... In the episode of Gridman, there was a friendly kaiju who was smart to make music for the world, but it was a kaiju had been destroyed and it was all very sad, but it was fine in the end. And I guess, Gridman or G, they resolved that amicably and were able to kind of keep on doing the thing and won't bother them. Actually, as well, the OG Gridman, he actually shows up at the junk shop to buy a keyboard or a guitar.
Yeah, he's like, have you got any more keyboards? And your man's just being a really crappy shop assistant.
I don't know.
If you don't see them, they're not there, or something like that, yeah.
So this is, with all those elements put in, this is very much a semi-sequel to the original Gridman, then.
Yeah, it seems to be covering similar things, but obviously that kaiju references the fact that it was helped out, and that's why it wants to help him out, by explaining most of the plot to him.
Yes.
Yeah.
Also, as I say, it's the same point in the series as episode 6 in both series that this character appears. But he's also, that makes me wonder, with the weapons all named after the superhuman Samurai Cyber Squad's versions, are they actually from that series rather from Gridman?
Oh, they're like a fucking... They're like that program download into Gridman 2.
Yeah.
Right,
the explanation she gives in this story is all illustrated by crappy computer graphics.
Oh, like a fucking, like a SimCity kind of looking thing, yeah.
Yeah,
that was pretty great.
I was thinking more, you probably thought the same thing, what they do, that Bakawan episode with the news graphics.
Yes.
Yeah, but it obviously had a bunch of, like, Minecraft on there as well with the... We're talking about creating her own world and that kind of thing. Yeah.
Or the Inferno Cop karaoke video.
Okay.
Which I believe was also referenced last episode. I believe the fight scene is, like, a legitimate version of the fight scene in that.
Yeah, your man's looking more and more like Overjustice as well. I'm waiting for him to be fucking behind a desk, you know? I mean, like, he was literally sitting on a desk, but not behind a desk.
Literally standing on her house at the end of the series, at the end of the episode, which makes you think, he's just pretending that he's in a digital world for her. They're actually all in a digital world with him.
Yes.
Yeah, like he's, like, I think that's what the kaiju was suggesting, that
yes.
it's something from outside interfering with this, like on fucking Reboot or something, I don't fucking know.
Yeah, it's kind of weird too, like he's like going to be the ultimate kind of end bad guy, he looks very imposing, he says on Roof of House, he's like, where is she? I'm bored.
I'm getting worried about her. Are we not going to have a kaiju in this episode? Alright, fair enough.
Yeah, they stop Auntie from killing Yuta by basically blocking his attacks and telling him, look at him. He doesn't look like a Gridman to you. He's a human being. If you kill him, you won't be able to fight Gridman.
Yeah.
You're right.
And he's kind of like caught with the logic of it. It's like, oh, I guess that's true. It is Gridman specifically I want to fight, not the guy who turns into Gridman or whatever way you want to call it. Yeah.
But I love the way they animate his eyes dashing and darting about.
Yeah. He's getting some really good development, all right.
He's a feral child. He's very twitchy.
I guess there's that too. They finally sorted out the stinking problem, though.
Yes. Yeah, I did like that both of the kaiju stunk.
Kaiju don't have the same kind of hygiene standards, I guess, yeah. Oh, he fucking pulled out the Rodimus circular saw as well, though.
Did he have that?
Yeah, he had in the movie, he had a circular saw.
Oh, yeah, he did. Shit.
It takes me out of it every fucking time, man.
I'm so glad that I don't get all these
references.
Yeah,
no, you're better off. I think, you're obviously going to enjoy this show way more than I am. And I'm still enjoying it, but it fucking does take me out of the emotional moment or the plot moment that they're trying to set up.
I usually just watch it once and then, like Twitter inform you of anything I might have missed. And go, oh, yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I think this is my favourite thing currently airing this season.
That's fair.
Just in terms of the story, but also the general production level has been pretty consistent throughout 6 episodes. Mm. Which is more than you can say for most.
Yeah, I like the little kind of conceived as well as that film. This is like a story about giant monsters fighting each other in the city and superheroes come along to save them, but it's actually all going to be more centering around a very small, very personal, emotional core. These events are all being precipitated by somebody's feelings of angst and anxiety and sadness and loneliness towards the world around them.
And the fact that we're like liking the even, yeah, the yeah. fact that we're liking even the goofy characters more so than the big fights. Well, and the big fights are great when they happen, but it's kind of fun to see all these guys who are living weapons wandering around like spying on people's dates, I guess.
Yeah. It's kind of like how just a very a small personal thing, like, you know, we had a kind of negative feeling can become, you know, an even greater thing. It could go from kind of sadness to loneliness to hatred to destroy the world with giant monsters, you know. Just kind of, when left alone, it festers into something far worse.
I highly recommend watching any Kamen Rider series produced in the last 20 years. Something like that almost every single week. Current one, Zio, is very much doing that gimmick.
Right.
With the time travel theme, it tends to be, somebody wanted to change something, and so that turns them into a monster, as they're taken advantage of by the real bad guys. If they are the real bad guys in Zio. It's hard to tell, because ostensibly our hero is the real bad guy, because we see at the very start of the series, he has conquered the Earth. As a despot, 50 years in the future.
Good for him.
He decides that, yes, he's still going to become a king, but he's just going to try and be a good one, not like the bad one these people from the future have told him he turned into.
Oh, he's like Rao. The only way to bring peace is through force.
Yeah. He's like Rao if Rao had to fill in, like, a career questionnaire in his last year of high school. And put in king as what he wanted to do when he grew up. I need to get back to watching Zio. Or at least trying to. It's not that good. But it is weird. Particularly the web bits where they're almost half breaking character and talking about the episodes. Anyway, on to Gegege no Kitaro, episode 32, Demon, is it Belial?
Belial.
I think they pronounce it Belial, yeah.
The 100-year grudge.
I feel like this is a separate story that they was able to conveniently fall into the Western Yokai arc.
That is correct. Unfortunately, he, unlike in the comic, he didn't test his powers by summoning pancakes.
Oh, what dark magic is this?
Fucking most of the comic sounds better to me when you describe it, man. I'm just like, I want to see that. Now I'm disappointed by this episode, and I liked it initially.
But otherwise, it's pretty similar in terms of... I can't remember who he's mad at. I don't think it's the Tengu. Or maybe it is the Tengu in that.
Could be.
I'm pretty sure it's probably Ratman broke the seal, though, in the comic.
Yeah, because the guy who knocked over the pile of rocks has the cursed gem underneath it, so that's probably usually Ratman doing that kind of thing. But it was some other dope this time, so he's blameless in this.
I don't really blame the Tengu, man. A fucking stiff breeze knocked that fucking pile of rocks over. Yeah. I think it's the seals. I think they need to do more solid seals. Like that thing with the well with the giant cap in it, that was great, but also bury it. You know, you gotta fucking do multiple layers of sealing, I think.
He shouldn't be showing off to girls. That's the problem.
Maybe the adults who are also smart and know what's best for them should have done a better job of hiding this cursed gem, you know, not under a rock. Maybe put it into a safe and throw it in the bottom of the ocean something.
Or, have the gem sealed in a pile of rocks on a cushion so that it doesn't, immediately fall and shatter to the ground when the rocks fall over. It's something. I don't know.
If it does a concern about me throwing my kicking my football through the window, maybe I should make stronger windows. How about that?
Yeah, but kicking the ball through a window doesn't summon a fucking demon's power, so he can take advantage of being a homeless man.
I don't know. My mom's got some temper on her.
Oh, dear.
Anyway, he opens up with Mana reading a comic on her phone about an Oni in love with a human, which makes her feel all lovey-dovey. Then she sees the witch she's got a crush on and invites her out on a date, essentially.
Yeah, she basically, uses it as... And the witch points out, you just wanted a fucking excuse to have a go on the broom, didn't you?
And I was like, oh, I think she just wanted an excuse to wrap her arms around your waist, but...
That makes it a love triangle now, right?
It does, but Agnes is aware that the Tengu has got a crush on Mana.
Yeah.
And keeps on trying to egg him on to say something, but he can't bring himself to do it.
Yeah.
but yeah, his master's mad at him because his inner eye is clouded with this love for a human he's got.
And he can't do the cool Tengu ninjutsu kind of stuff, yeah.
Then he sees Agnes and Mana. He's like, oh, they start showing off. Unleashes the Belial's power. What's Belial doing up to that point?
He's being homeless.
Homeless.
He's selling magazines he found in the bin.
Yes.
And the cops are fucking, you know.
I got your 2-week-old Shonen Jump here. Anybody want it? No? Okay.
He's like, oh, why did I even come to Japan? This is bullshit.
He accounts his life and has to update it, realizing that, hang on, it's not the 1960s anymore. I better update this to it. Been 150 years I've been in Japan, not 100.
It's actually nearly been 150, rather, even though it's still called the 100-year grudge, because it's not quite
50 years. He's a Portuguese demon who fled from the West to Japan.
I thought he invaded Japan, much like Portugal invaded culturally.
I think he just stowed away on one of the boats and was like, I may be
concatenating it in the what's in the comic.
He basically
fled, got his power sealed, and then he was annoyed that, here I am in a foreign country, and I don't even have my powers.
And now I'm just some weird, grey, homeless man on the street.
Yes. It's like he got mugged, lost his, like, all his money, his passport, and it's like, oh no, I'm trapped here now.
Yeah, it's a weird one.
Gets his power back, but then the ring shows up, so Blackbeard's like, Backbeard, I'm still thinking about One Piece, says, get that ring for me, and you can be like my right-hand demon. And so they have a bit of a fight. He buries all the Tengu apart from our young one who's in love with Mana.
Because he wasn't there, I think, mostly.
Yeah, he didn't kill them. He's just like, well, see how you like being buried, sealed up under a pile of rocks. Kidero shows up. Does he get a report from a crow about what's going on?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like that's the plot mechanism to get Kitaro to go places, both in the comic and in the manga.
Well, a letter or a crow, yeah.
A letter or a crow, one of those two things, yes.
Text now, I think, is the new thing as well, though. that's been introduced.
That's true, and occasionally, like, a new yokai shows up in the forest and says, we got trouble wherever we're from. Please come and help us, Kitaro. And yeah, so he's doubting himself, and Mana says, no, you've got the power. You've got the power of love.
Don't need money. Don't take fame.
Yes.
Don't need a credit card.
So he's able to focus himself, and Belial at this point has split himself into 6 orbs.
Oh, yeah, the different, with different organs.
6 fucking behelits from Berserk with different.
Yes.
Things on them, like eyes and nose and shit on them.
Which one did he hide in? Was it the ear? The one you wouldn't think? Or was it the nose one?
I think it was the nose. Okay. I think it was in the nose.
I guess an ear is more useful than a nose, or you regard it as more useful.
Yeah, that's where it hid
his
vital organs.
Yeah, pretty much.
And so then the Tengu boy throws a stick through him. And does the job. Seals them all up again, and then Agnes uses her Western magic to restore the village. Kidero doesn't do much in this episode at all, really.
Yeah, I was like, wait, thinking sure about he it. Gets a hit in, and I was like, no, he doesn't actually get a hit in, fuck.
But, does he shoot?
No, he doesn't even... He does, but he doesn't... He's not the one... It's the Tengu is the one who defeats... Belial, which is, I suppose, his fair. I'm trying to think... I'm getting them mixed up. I know there's a few stories where it's occasionally Kitaro. The story is, Kitaro has to go and fetch somebody else who's more powerful to take care of things.
Hmm.
Which I guess we've had in this. There was the episode with that god who showed up. They had to go and petition him to save the day, didn't they?
Hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it was just fine. I enjoyed this episode because I like. I'm partly this goodwill from reading the comic because it was one of my favourite strips.
Okay.
A big, mainly partly because of that pancake summoning.
Oh, you think that would make you like it less? Hmm.
No, I like, well, it not being in there, but I quite like the design for the character and his backstory of coming to Japan and then kind of getting stranded there. Mm. And it's a way, I'm going to guess it's gonna, this Blackbeard thread is a way to get in a lot of these other Western yokai stories into this.
Yeah, they were working for Blackbeard all this time, yeah.
Yes. Or, well, he wasn't. Literally, he wasn't. He was only once he got his power back, but that Blackbeard goes, ah, oh, hang on a minute, you're there. The ring's there.
Well, that's just kind of a dick move by Blackbeard. It was kind of like, I wasn't interested in you up until you got your power back. And now I'll, yes. Yeah, now I'll give you an offer.
Yeah, you would think that if, yeah, Blackbeard's done nothing to unseal that power.
Yeah, all you had to do was, like, summon your werewolf guy. He didn't even have to turn into werewolf and go over and kick a pile of rocks over. And you would have had this guy back in your army, but all right.
Well, I'm going to guess it's because he's an American yokai, you see. He doesn't care for these old world yokai.
Right.
He needs some new money. Some new yokai. Yes.
I can't say it was nothing stood out animation-wise as dazzling.
Mm.
But it was definitely an episode of Kitaro. Anything else to add before we move on to Honda-san? On to Honda-san, then. School-faced bookseller Honda-san, episode 6, The Man with a Secret Power, and El Fair Day War. You thought I didn't watch it, but while you were talking about Thunderbolt Fantasy, I was secretly watching school-faced bookseller Honda-san in order to catch up.
Dear.
So this introduces a new guy, Kendo-san. He wears a kendo mask. He's been transferred out of dispatch.
Which generally is all like physical labor, and it's shown by him building a pyramid.
But this is mainly to introduce his boss from dispatch, whose name escapes me, but he's the man with the secret power.
Is that fucking Frieza again?
It's Ryu Sei Nakao, yes.
Okay, I thought it was. Because it was a remarkably subdued performance.
He's assistant manager Matsutsushi.
Yeah, where he can, like, summon the books that you need on occasion.
Yes. Well, you know you need
yeah,
them.
Yeah.
Because he's always watching the news. Mm. And figures out what books will be in demand based on what's in the news.
Yeah, like, what's coming out.
And this has a Kitaro tie-in.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it was like, Shigeru Mizanki passed away, so it's probably better put all of his famous books and stuff about up front and center onto displays, because you're probably going to be getting a big uptick in sales on those.
That's what the old guy was reading in the end, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm not sure it was Kitaro. It might be a different comic he did. I think it might be
one. Saying, like, I know these are comics for kids, but it kind of really brings me back. And I think he said, like, I'm the same age as him or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely one of his. But it wasn't Kitaro that he picked up. It was another one, because he was saying, I normally get. Yes. I like the ones, but you rarely see this one.
Yeah, it was like a work by the same guy, not a volume of Kitaro. Yes. Yeah.
And yeah, they were panic because they couldn't find the Akuma-kuns and they were still in the boxes.
The many special orders, so they're panicking, trying to figure out which boxes.
Sorry, the *Ak*-*Mercun*, just in case you couldn't figure it out.
They're very not hiding what they are, but yeah, they're just barely covering it up.
What was the one? I'm calling up a comedy guy. Coming, calling something like Poop Pop Tepic. Is that? Did you have a comment on that?
Yeah, it was Pop Poop Peptic.
Yeah, very subtle, guys.
Yeah, that was the lead into the second half of the story, which was their Our Fair Day War, where they discuss fair days in Japanese book. It sounds a bit like how the fair days at schools would work, but this time it's dressing up, picking a theme. Dressing up your bookshop in order to try and...
Yeah. Well, I mean, you see that in some bookshops where they have the recommended by staff, and they'll have, like, a little write-up about why they like this series or book or anything like that.
Mm.
Yeah.
But the real meat of the episode appears to be the author complaining about one particular publisher's habit of attaching double-sided photo add-ons to books.
And also, and like, then... being in customer service in any fucking regard whatsoever.
Yes.
Fucking hell.
But he seems more mad at the publisher for doing it that way rather than the actual customers.
I mean, across the room, you get so fucking psychopathic about, where is my fucking bookmark with the font photo on it? You fucking idiot! Where is it? It's to turn it over! Oh, it's on either side! My apologies.
Oh, it's double-sided. My mistake. Sorry for
I didn't mean to
earlier.
Threaten to fucking kill you and destroy you and burn your body to ashes.
Poor fucking skeleton a heart attack, like, you know.
I haven't had my coffee today.
They were going to do, like, a movie adaptation theme.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, but due to various copyright issues for his Western comics section, he had to, like, make handmade things. He couldn't get real publicity materials.
Yeah, yeah, and one guy was
which
looking for
upset the guy from Light Novels.
Because he wanted to enjoy the posters and stuff.
Yes.
I thought he was saying he was going to, like, take the posters once it was done and put them up at home. But he's like, no, I just wanted to enjoy them in the fucking shop.
Yes. It was like, after we closed down, I just wanted to enjoy them.
It's the little pleasures, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, what was Wesker, the light novel guy, got? Because he's not shown up much at all.
Oh, that light novel guy was... Was he the gas mask guy? No, it was...
He was in this episode,
He was in this... Oh, who's the fucking guy? Oh.
Yeah.
I can see him. He walked in the door. And he was...
What kind of helmet is he wearing?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of myself.
I've blanked it up. Anyway, it was notable because it wasn't one of the six other supporting characters we regularly see. Which they nicely divided up between men and women this episode, as they're all commenting on the physique of Kendo-san.
They're all enamoured with him.
Yes.
Oh, that's good.
So nice.
He's powerful and nice, and has a soft voice. Yes. Everyone's into that.
Though I do like the bit where he's dealing with the customers and they comment on how much it's aged on the sand. He's a welding mask, is the guy he's got.
Okay,
from,
like, yeah.
And there were some other jokes that I didn't get because they were book-related.
Oh, I'm guessing I'm like missing, like, fucking half the jokes in this thing most of the time, yeah.
It was, like, the mix of what the night mask woman who's in charge of the boys love. I was like,
I feel like when they're cutting between, it's like when there's an anime adaptation or there's a movie adaptation or there's a thing, you know. I feel like the covers they flash by, like, the really crudely drawn things, I'm guessing those are very specific franchises.
Yeah, I think there's an Osamatsu reference in there.
I think
there
was,
well,
yeah.
There is, yeah.
But yeah, it was fun. I'll enjoy it even more when I listen to it with the sound on. I was too busy playing Red Dead Redemption 2. I do apologise. But I did watch Double Decker, Doug and Kirill, Episode 8, Dancing Academy Investigation. In which they go to school, back to school, to find out who's attacking people who are candidates to be... The prom queen, or dance party queen.
I was just going to say, should we all, like, put on, like, fake American accents? Like, we're going to prom, or something like that. Like,
dance party.
I can hear you saying dance party. Fucking, you can't trick me. I mean, like, it's essentially, they are talking about, like, the king and queen of the dance party rather than prom. And it's the same function, but yeah, it's an odd choice.
So... They've given various rules because this is a very important school where lots of the top brass went to.
It kind of makes me not like the chief for just bucking into everything just so he might get a promotion, but yep. I do enjoy his squirming, so that's good too.
And, well, you got to admire the fact that he doesn't cover it up. He explains exactly why
there's no fucking two bits about it. He's doing it because he's trying to fucking sidle up to the fucking bosses so he can get a promotion.
And so, yeah, they're going to have Max do the be the lead in the investigation. Originally with... it's Max and Robot to begin with.
Yeah, because Kirill's
and
mad.
And then it becomes
like,
Max and
yeah,
Kirill.
Yeah, Kirill's like, I thought this was our case. And it's like, you've got another very important job, wearing the animal mascot costume.
Sure, McGruff, the crime rabbit.
I fucking loved it when Doug changed roles with him. You could see him just falling asleep in that fucking thing the entire fucking episode. Like, he was just using it. It's like, oh, brilliant, I could Skype off in that, and no one will know. dear.
And so, yeah, there's a various complicated high school relationships going on. There's somebody who wants to stop the dance entirely, who
appears to be missing an eye.
She does, yes.
I thought she's just really cool and has an eye patch. That was her character trait.
I guess they're leaning into, like, this is... They're trying to make her look so stereotypically the person who
did it. Oh, the baddie, yeah. She's a high school girl, but she does have an eye patch and an evil mustache, so, yeah.
Yes, so they're trying to put to the point where you know, as the viewer, because it's this show, that they didn't do it.
Yeah, and also, freaking Boxer has... Max has... she knows exactly who it is, like, straight a fucking way, and she's talking to that character the most.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, that's the character she relates to.
Yes, in a similar kind of position. Not the same kind of thing, but...
No, not the same, but it's like being so much of a friend to somebody that you'll go further for them. But at least it was reciprocal.
With her. Yeah.
With her.
She was hoping her friend would be the same kind of friend that... what was her friend called? Not Charlie.
Connor.
Connor, that was it. Yeah. The same kind of friend Connor was to her, like that kind of thing.
Yeah. But it wasn't, no. It was,
her friend was a shit.
It was... yeah. Typical US high school TV drama. With somebody who refers to... Yeah, it was very confusing. I had to, like, remind myself, oh, no, she constantly refers to herself in third person.
Well, they do comment on that, so...
That was super
keep up
they
them.
Do.
Yeah.
She's supposed to be that way.
Yes.
No, why would you talk to Tiffany that way? It's like, but you're Tiffany.
I know. Tiffany knows. Ah, damn it.
You let it slip. Yeah.
So the villain in the episode was the girl who was... She wanted to be, like, second place and make sure the person she admired the most became first place.
Her friend who got her in with the popular kids,
Yes. But she only got in because she had taken Anthem to make herself more beautiful.
Saying the word beautiful. So, yeah, it is some sort of, like, a one-wish kind of thing. Yeah.
Yes. But then when she realizes she's a false friend, she then overdoses, and we see what the effect of an overdose is.
Yeah.
In this case, you turn into a giant wasp person.
It's kind of the exact same as all the other times in which Anthem, you turn into a giant wasp. Like, how is this any different, Doug?
I think in this one, because your one can talk her down in that form, it's not like she's purposely taken on a form due to her emotional state or something like that. It's like you can talk her down from this. Because she does manage to convince her to stop, and the bug face, it appeals back, and you can see her human face underneath. So I guess that's a little different so far. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. The best bit, though, is early on when Kirill's trying to cover up that robots are robots.
Oh, whoo! And he winks at her, going like, well, that was a close one. We nearly revealed that you're secretly a robot. It's like, my nickname is literally Robot. Everyone knows. But she doesn't want to tell him because she's too nice.
I think he just wants to dance a robot, because when they have the surprise party at the end, he's doing the robot.
He realized, I'm pretty good at this. Also,
I figured they thought it was such a funny gag the first time he danced the robot, therefore they should just have him doing it again.
Yeah,
we learn a little bit of Max's past about how her friend Connor...
It went a very different way than what I thought it was going.
Yeah, But at the start, you see her in her room when she's crying, and it's like Maxine, are you okay in there? She's like the girl with the pigtails, the big glasses, and she just takes a scissors to her hair and think, oh, what happened at school? She's getting bullied. But
and
no,
the
it was something robot's else.
Trying to tell her, it's like, oh yeah, she went through some shit in high school. She couldn't go to the prom and she became a policewoman. And it's like, wait, what? Yeah, she never gets to fully explain the story until the end, and you think it's like, oh, because she was bullied and she wanted a sense of justice, and it's like a very different reason why she wanted a sense of justice. She was comfortable in herself. Really good reveal. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I thought it. I think, like I say, I think whatever they do clumsily, I think they're still there.
I think they're trying.
The right place.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Yes.
That's why I'm kind of willing to forgive that fucking. Again, they did it as a reveal, as a fucking joke, but not realizing how inappropriate or crude a joke that is.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're trying. They're really fucking trying.
They seem at least aware that, you know, it is like a fucking. Some of the people out there who are this way and are very serious about this way and won't take kindly to mining it for fucking obnoxious jokes, as most of your fucking mass media has done for the last, like, forever. So even some glint of self-awareness about that, even in this, as clumsy as it may be, is still very much appreciated.
I appreciate how it's trying to do, like, LGBTQIA plus kind of things very, they're just there in the world and nobody questions it. Like, when, that few episodes ago when they were out on a domestic dispute and it was two guys, it was just like, yeah, it's just the thing. It's just people's being people. And obviously the hatred that's this, or the bigotry that's displayed towards it for Max's, backstory is a thing that's like, yeah, that's not a thing we should let happen ever. That's a good thing to fight against. Mm. Really quite well done, I thought.
Yeah, I might have liked a couple more beats of how that got her to then be a cop.
Yeah, I guess you do just jump straight to cop after that. But I guess it's the sense of that she wanted to make sure that didn't happen again. Because obviously she was trying to... She was giving that that cheerleader one some slack. It was like, I was hoping your friend could fucking talk you out of this, but turns out your friend's a dick. So she is trying to, like, she has a peg straight away who the fucking criminal is, but she wants to get them to a better place. She doesn't want it to happen again, the same way it happened to her friend.
Well, maybe she was always wanted to be a police officer. It is the
That's it too, yeah.
She's assumed, oh, fucking knitting, big glasses, she's just going to be wanted to be with, I don't know. I brought some shit. Nope, she wanted a job where she could ride motorbikes all day. So she got.
Yeah, when the robot asked her, is like, hey, how come you never let your hair grow out again? It's like, because I look fucking class, I think was the answer to that question, right?
Yeah, I look good in this.
Yeah, it's a good fucking look. So, yeah, yeah. But also a big dance party at the end where you have so many odd pairings, but just that are played just totally like it's a normal thing. It would be odd pairings in any other fucking show.
The oddest thing in the dance party is Apple Bieber apparently scratching and that not being reflected at all in the music which he's playing.
Yeah, I think he's just trying to look cooler. It's basically, that's his entire fucking character. Yeah.
That's definitely just someone's, like, they've plugged their, like, MP3 player into the speakers and he's just...
He's on his headphones thinking...
Just let him do it. He wants to do this.
Yeah.
He wants to take part in the party. He wants to be cool. Let's let him have a go for one night. It's prom after all. Oh, sorry. It's a dance party after all.
There's a bit in the episode, I can't remember what it was about. There's a bit where someone's about to explain anything and the narrator interrupts and says he's going to explain it instead.
The
significance of prom to teenagers.
He's going to explain a dance party, and he's like, oh, fucking, she's going to take too fucking long. I'll fucking do it, says the narrator.
Oh. I'm sorry for punching the microphone. I was punching the windshield.
The narrator's just too lazy to listen to. What's her name? It's not Newbie. It's
Rookie.
Rookie. To listen to Rookie's explanation of what a dance party is.
I do like that he just gets annoyed at other characters, not just Kirill and Travis.
It was just a hilarious circumstance of events that he met this guy before. I'm not going to fucking explain it now. We're just going to fast forward to when they know each other. Doesn't matter. You don't need to know that. It's not an unreliable narrator. It's narrator who gets annoyed at how long the story is taking to tell, which is a weird situation, yeah.
Oh, there's a point where they're like, oh, where are we going to go to get something to eat? Well, Derek's is the only place that's opening. Let's go around your... you can come around my flat instead. Don't.
Yeah.
They're just horrible to Derek.
And like, he's like, oh, I was going to give them my Derek special number two, and I wanted to see what new frozen food he found he can just put in a deep fat fryer and just fucking knock it out of his shitty bus restaurant. I really enjoy how shitty they are to Derek. It's kind of great.
I mean, he's extra great by the fact that they did that whole bit in the previous in the early episodes where Kirill thinks he was dead. And not only is he not dead, they're horrible to him.
I guess that's why they never explained, because, like, yeah, fuck Derek, man. He was a real piece of shit.
He's just a
dope. Like, the worst you can say is his food is just basic-ass frozen food. Like, there's nothing fancy to it. I mean, like, maybe his bartending is also basic, but, yeah.
Well, that's why he had to get a bartender.
That's someone who could actually mix drinks. That fancy shaking he's doing in the opening, that's just a beer.
Shouldn't do that to a beer. What?
Yeah, exactly. He's bad at it, is what I'm saying. Okay.
Righto, I do believe that is everything all wrapped up for the week.
Thank God.
So be back here next week for Sex Pistols Appear Part 1. And in the meantime, check out our regular podcasts at SecretOfTheSailorMadness.com and DynamiteInTheBrain.com. Goodbye.
Wiedersehen.